Welcome back to the Dear Katie podcast. This is Katie Kastner and
this is Claire Kaplan. As always, I want to remind our listeners that sometimes the discussions can be a little difficult to hear and to process, especially for survivors of trauma. So we encourage you to care for your safety and well-being. Reach out for emotional support from family or friends, counselor if you have one, or our hotline. We'll provide some additional resources at the end of the podcast from the Take Back the Night Foundation.
Thank you so much, Clara. And today we are so excited to welcome Emma Goldman Sherman. Emma, you have had such a lifelong experience of so many things to offer. But as we always do, I love to tell our listeners, share with them where you grew up, a little bit about your background and how you started out your existence.
Thank you so much. I grew up in a tiny little town outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It was called Ballachinwood. It was mostly settled by the Welsh, and then it became just a regular middle-class place to grow up with little patches of lawn, every house very separate, but not too far from each other. And it seemed very idyllic. However, it was not at all, especially not for me. I did not know that I was autistic at the time. And it is also very common for autistic people to be abused. I don't know how much that had to do with the fact that I was abused, but I was abused as a child, as an infant even, for the first 12 years of my life, mostly sexually, but also emotionally and physically. And so it was a really rough time in a very sort of beautiful little place.
And about what time are we talking? Was this 10 years, 30 years? How long ago?
So we're talking almost 60 years ago. This was 1965 when I was born.
Wow. And
yeah, it was a long time ago.
No worries. That helps our listeners. And also, I'd like to think about the family and the roof, your little patch of lawn. I'm already imagining, you know, the house in Bala outside of Philly is on, quote, the main line where, you know, the affluent and the less affluent sort of mix. But did you have siblings and did you have two parents at the time?
I did until I was 11, have two parents together. They fought constantly. I had a younger sister and we had people in the house helping out. I had a housekeeper.
Oh, wow. Who, that's good.
Yeah, I had a housekeeper who was Black. I had a handyman who was Black and we are white. And there was a really big sort of divide in terms of where I got my love and affection and care and my parents.
Interesting. Can you explain what you just said just a little bit?
Sure. I have a lot of memories of physical abuse between myself and my mother to the point where I fought back and we had knockdown drag out fights when I was a kid.
When you say when a kid, like how young were you when this started?
I don't remember. She was a pincher. She was a slapper. She was a grabber. My upper arms were always purple.
Oh, my goodness. Was your mother at home and your father was at work or what was that looking like?
Yes, until I was 11 and she went to work finally. She was at home, but she was a tennis player. She was a shopper. She had her hair done at a weekly place every week. She would get her hair done every Saturday. They would go out or we would host parties. We were pretty middle class, like it was a split level, pretty average house, but I definitely went to a private school and there were a lot of very wealthy people who owned major brands that you would have heard of.
Like, was it co-ed or single sex? Like an Agnes or an Episcopal?
It was single sex and it was lovely. Like school was a really safe place. Thank goodness.
Baldwin?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. I've spoken there.
What? Did you go there?
No, I didn't go to private school. I spoke there, though.
You spoke there. Fabulous.
Yes, a lecture.
It's a wonderful place to go to school because they really have a structure and you know what's expected of you. And that helped me enormously. Whereas in my home, I could never be sure where I was, if I was in trouble, if I was not in trouble, what was going to happen. Who wanted what from me?
Yeah, just one second. So you had a younger sister or an older sister?
A younger.
younger. And so we had until 11, your mom's at home and mayhem has started. And when you said abuse, it sounds like all kinds of abuse. And the primary person was your mom, or were there others as well?
My father was sexually abusive with me from a very young age, and my mother did not want to know about that.
So you had no place of safety at home at all?
I had a wonderful housekeeper, and she was loving, and she was kind, and she was warm, and she helped me a lot in terms of being a place that I could go to and loved and held and cared for as long as my mother and my father weren't around.
Wow. That's incredible. I'm so glad you shared that, Emma, because I don't think we've talked about how you can find solace and care at a young age from other people who are not relatives. And this is probably the first time we've talked about that and heard from someone who had that fortunate experience. It must have been really still very challenging, but at least you had someone.
Yes, until I was 8 years old, and we moved from there.
Oh, wow. And did you move far or not far?
Not too far. We moved to Gladwin, to a much larger house, and it was just too far a commute.
So I'm sure Claire has questions, but maybe we can talk a little bit about this is while you're a child into your teen years and you're at Baldwin. And then does it end when you go off? Do you go off to college? What happens next?
The sexual abuse really ends once I get my period.
Okay.
So that was like a red flag or something to my father. And he ended things right then and there. He was like, I heard you got your period. So that was that. And he actually got married within like a few months of that to his second wife. And so that was really confusing for me because I didn't understand the nature of our relationship. I knew it was private, but I kind of thought it was love to me in some marital sort of way because I took things very literally. I'm autistic. So my brain is like, oh, if you do this, then, you know, you're married. So I really thought I was next in line. And then he married a woman from his office who became my stepmother. And it gets very complicated.
You said that you believe that you were second in line, right? After your father divorced your mother. And you thought that because of the things that you were doing with your dad, that you were married. So I'm wondering, when did all that start and how did he frame it to you? Do you remember how he talked about it with you?
I don't really, but I know that I thought I was expected to grow up to be female, first of all, because I didn't feel female as a little person, but it was hammered on both sides, mom and dad, that I was female, that I was supposed to have a sexual relationship with a man. And that was what I was going to grow up to be. Like, there were really no options in any other way. That was it. That was my role. And I had to figure out how to do that where I could actually stand it. And I knew it was painful. I knew it was difficult. But, like, I got it into my head that that was my job. So my mother sort of tried to help me out by saying, if you don't like this job, become an actor, go into theater and learn how to pretend to like this job. And so I had all this theater training, and instead of going to regular college, I ended up going to Boston University for a BFA in performance. And I was literally like learning how to be female in a kind of drag way, because I don't feel that way as a person. So for example, I was the very first female body that auditioned for that program with the male role. I auditioned as Romeo. And they said, like, no girl has ever done that before. And lots of boys auditioned as Juliet. That was common, but not the other way around.
Did you get the part?
I did.
Wow, awesome. So you were basically told by your parents that you need to learn to act as if. And that was in your gender identity, sexual identity, and even things that you didn't want to be doing related to your dad, basically. Your mom was not aware or did not, or was in denial about what was happening with your dad?
She was in pretty deep denial, yeah.
That's a lot for a little kid. And when did you start putting Okay, so your dad remarried. So when did you start putting two and two together that this was not okay?
When he remarried, it felt like a slap in the face. It felt like this huge rejection that I didn't know what to do with. So I stopped speaking to him. I didn't speak to him for about 6 months, being 12 years old. And it damaged our relationship enormously, which is strange because it was a hugely abusive relationship. But I didn't know that. I just felt like I lost him.
Of course. And you probably believed you loved him and you thought he loved you.
I did. And I thought, this is what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to go out on my own and make sex happily okay. Try to learn how to have sex with people. Like, I had no concept about relations. I had only this idea of sexuality. So I proceeded to have sex with everyone I encountered.
Wow, that's amazing. Do you remember having any barriers about what could be considered consensual or not? Or were you in the position where you made the overture and everyone welcomed the opportunity?
I didn't understand anything about boundaries. I didn't know I could say no ever. I didn't understand how, like, my demeanor, just even making eye contact with people, because it was important to my mother that I could make eye contact with people, that I knew how to make eye contact. And she would point that out. And so I would make contact with strangers, and they just assumed that was, oh, she likes me. So I was trying to figure out how I could get through this sexual act by practicing.
It's so interesting what you're talking about, eye contact, which is obviously a challenge for some people who are artistic or neurodivergent. That is an issue. So that your parents were aware that you were not doing it and that you need to learn how, which then led to what you're describing right now, which is you make eye contact with someone, that's a come on.
Right.
And I had no clue.
When did you learn that there was another narrative?
Once I was married, I realized, and I had had a child, and I was no longer even able to have sex. It was so just wild to me. It was so horrifying.
And I thought,
and my husband is fabulous, he's so supportive and so loving. And as a postpartum body that was severely traumatized by the birth, which was an emergency cesarean after 3 hours of pushing, there was just so much trauma that went into that. He wasn't relating to me afterwards as a sexual being. And this was a brand new relationship and a brand new marriage. So all of a sudden, I had this amazing epiphany that I didn't have to be a sexual being. And I was like, wait a minute, I had a rule about being a sexual being, like a rule from way back that I never realized was imagined. And so that was so freeing. Oh, I don't have to do this.
And Emma, just to back up again, I'd like to give context. You're such a great storyteller. So you jumped out like from 11 to married all of a sudden. I was like, oh my God, I just went through a decade. So we go to Baldwin, you graduate.
I don't graduate.
Oh, you don't graduate. Let's go back. You got in trouble. Okay, rebel rouser.
Okay, so by the time I'm a junior at Baldwin in high school, I need to get out of the house. I am having so much trouble. I'm living with my father at that point because my mother and I do not get along. So I've moved into my father's house with this new wife, and it's very difficult. It's very awkward. There are big fights. I'm very much a troubled teenager, doing drugs, getting into a lot of trouble, smashing up cars. I don't really have distance ability. So like a lot of autistic people, we have a hard time knowing where we are in space. And putting us in a car is really a bad idea. But because nobody knew, they just kept giving me the next car. So I was really having a lot of trouble, and I got in trouble for cheating in chemistry, some like plagiarized labs, and I wasn't allowed to graduate, or it's very confusing. It's such a long time ago. So I applied early admission to go to Boston University. I was 16, just barely turning 17, and I left, and I did not spend my senior year at Baldwin,
with the idea that I would actually finish that first year of college and those credits would help me graduate. But I was thrown out of that year of college because I got involved with a coke dealer and we were running cocaine to the sheriff's office of Boston from a loading dock in New York City. So yeah, I got in a lot of trouble because I didn't understand anything. And it was just really hard not having decent relationships with my parents. They couldn't impart any knowledge to me. I couldn't hear them. My mother at that point was dying of cancer. I was really alone and I didn't know who to turn to. I didn't even have a lot of understanding that I was a problem. The problem of autism is you can't really see yourself. The reflection isn't there. And I wasn't getting a lot of feedback from adults in my life. So with two sort of broken mirrors, I had no way of knowing what sort of damage I was doing, how I was behaving. I couldn't gauge any of it.
What a chaotic environment to be living in. And you sort of carried it with you into your young adulthood in a sense.
Yes. Yes. That's like two decades after, right? So my mother dies, I'm 19 and I get very depressed and I spend about 10 years in bed.
Yeah. So I think now we jump to how did you find this marriage partner? And how did you start to like come to a new understanding of yourself? But first you had to trust someone to get married. So how did that work out?
And were you living on your own at that point? I was living on my own. I had like survival gig jobs. I was a waitress. I was a receptionist. Yeah. And I just lived in tiny little apartments on my own in New York City where I'd always dreamed I would live, but I had no relationships. I had very little ability to reach out, to bond with people, to trust people. It was very difficult.
10 years of bad, wait, back up, explain what that means.
And so then I went to graduate school, which was outrageously weird because I had dropped out of high school. I had then spent 3 years in college. Yeah. The first year I was thrown out. Then I went back and did the BFA program for 2 years, was dismissed. That's another long story. And then really got very depressed and spent about 10 years in bed. And then I was 30 and I was writing plays. And somehow a friend of mine sent me to meet with the person who ran the playwriting master's program at the University of Iowa. And she invited me to join the program and offered me this fabulous fellowship. And then she was summarily fired. So I got a call from the dean saying, we understand you've been offered something and we need you to know there's no more program and you can't come. And because I don't trust anyone, I had said to her, I don't believe you. I need you to tell me what you're offering me in writing. Please send me a fax. This was 1993 or four. And so she sent me fax. So when the dean said, this is nonsense, this doesn't exist, I said, well, here's my fax. And I got 3 years of fabulous master's program at the University of Iowa in theater. I was able to also study in the poetry workshop and the dance department and the music composition department. It was fantastic.
The University of Iowa Writers Program is famous. So that's quite a coup. Wow.
It is. So it was miraculous. And that really helped me because then I had some skills. I didn't have people skills. And I didn't know I didn't have people skills, but I was starting to get the message that there were things people didn't like about me and I didn't understand what they were or why. And so I was really starting to look for ways to be a different kind of person. And then when 9/11 happened, I volunteered here in New York City to work on the suicide hotline for Marble Collegiate Church. And they do a 6-month training program in how to listen to people. And that was so helpful because then I could actually understand that there was another person outside of myself who existed and had feelings. And I could understand their feelings and that would help me with understanding them. And it was huge. I mean, it was just like mind blowing.
And I was 30 or 32 or 3 or something like that. So it took a long time. And that's about when I met my husband. And he would say things like, why are you okay when it's just us? And if we go out with other people, you're a nightmare. And so like, then I had some feedback. I was like, why am I a nightmare? He's like, you don't know when to speak and when not to speak. You interrupt. You are impossible. You act like nobody's in the room. And I was like, oh, okay, let's figure that out. And then, so that took about 10 years. And by the time I was diagnosed with autism, I was 56. So imagine, I mean, like, that's how clueless, that's how hard it was.
And when you were a kid, I know when I was a kid, nobody talked about autism. Nobody talked about ADHD. None of these things were even discussed. And girls, of course, are diagnosed much later than boys in both cases. So it sounds like you found a partner who was willing to give you feedback and stick with you as you went through this process.
He's amazing. We are together to this day and I adore him.
Yeah, I'll interrupt. Yeah, let's get into where you are now. I felt like we all took a big roller coaster ride with you. I did the loop-de-loop twice. I did the plunge where your stomach falls out of your self and lands on the floor. But you have been through a ton. And thank you so much for gracefully and graciously sharing it with our listeners. So as we kind of head to the last part of our conversation, it would be a delight to share kind of what you've done with your playwriting and your writing and how our listeners can learn from that part of your journey.
Okay. So what I did when I went to get my master's was I wrote tons and tons of plays, but I was always trying to be able to share a kind of internal experience that's very difficult to put on the stage. So I think a lot of my theater work is sort of problematic because I'm trying to do something the theater doesn't really do. And eventually that led me to write the play FUKT, which is really about the internal experience of someone who has been sexually abused as a child. And that was the play that I produced last year at the Tank in New York City. And it did really well. And that was where I got to partner with Take Back the Night. And we're hoping that I can use that to Off-Broadway. But really, I have done so much in terms of learning just because I was trying to heal myself, that I became a holistic health counselor and I became a coach to deal with trauma and grief and also attachment, because I had really a very difficult attachment situation with both my parents. And there's so much in that creates boundary issues and trust issues. And to be able to reach survivors and people who are struggling with this, I just think it's so important that people know that there are so many new modalities with healing that have certainly helped me enormously, and that I work with people as a writing coach in order to let them understand how they can regulate their system so that they're not walking around feeling unsafe in the world, right? Because surviving is terrifying. It's a really scary place to be, whether that happened when you were a child or as an older person, like whatever we've had to live through affects us in ways that it doesn't just affect our psychology. It affects us on a cellular level so that we could actually get sick and have all the autoimmune diseases that I've had. And more, right? We can really suffer physically from feeling unsafe in the world. So what I'm trying to do is help people be more aware of how they can heal and how healing doesn't have to be expensive and only for privileged people. It can actually come pretty organically and in a communal way.
Wow, that's fabulous. And so you had this play, it was successful, and then it's what else is happening with your...
I've also been commissioned to write a musical that I've been working on now for a few years. And I don't know if I can say the title of that either, but my titles are very provocative. But It's about autoimmune disease and the history of medical misogyny, because there is bias out there in the medical system that we have against people of color, certainly, and certainly against bodies that are female. And it is so pervasive and difficult to get beyond that. Diagnoses are difficult. And certainly we don't have a trauma-informed medicine yet. And until we have real trauma-informed medicine, doctors don't really know what to deal with, how to deal with patients who come to them from a significant trauma, traumatized background. And that changes everything. And so if we can know that we have trauma, like for a long time, I didn't even know I was traumatized because I blocked out a lot of the childhood sexual abuse. But if we do know that there's trauma, that means we have special needs, and medicine needs to acknowledge that. And there are now ways that more and more doctors are learning about that. Like the musical is fun. It's comedy. It's not trying to demonize the system, but we need change. We need trauma-informed medicine in a broad way across this whole country. So,
yeah, Emma, as we kind of leave this episode, we always like to ask our guests to share advice and recommendations for healing. You've definitely done a lot, but what do you think are some accessible ways that you deal with daily triggers, perhaps? One, that you deal with daily triggers, if you have them, and two, what can our survivors do to help grow and heal themselves?
So I think with daily triggers and with a kind of internal dialogue that is not necessarily healthy, right? A kind of self-blaming, a kind of I'm not enough, internal dialogue, I'm not moving forward fast enough, whatever those things are. Because when I'm triggered, I tend to get frustrated with myself and turn my frustration on myself. So I think that the best thing that I have done is to really cultivate a practice of self-compassion, where I literally put my hand on my heart, on my chest, on my heart space, and offer myself some calm, loving presence. Like, I am here for you, and I know you are suffering, and I'm sorry. That was hard. Whatever just happened, whatever was triggering, was hard, and I'm sorry, and I love you, and I forgive you for how you struggle. And that kind of self-compassion and love and forgiveness is really important to shift us out of self-blame, out of a victim mentality, into a stronger, more grounded, regulated kind of person.
Yep, for sure. Emma, great, amazing. Thank you for taking us on your roller coaster ride. Claire, would you be able to close us out and give our listeners some next steps?
Sure, absolutely. So thank you, Emma, again, for joining us. This was a wonderful conversation, and I'm going to carry it with me for some time. And we're also grateful to those of you who joined us for this episode of Dear Katie Survivor Stories. If you need support but don't know where to find it, if you visit takebackthenight.org, you can find a list of resources and how to reach our legal support hotline. You can also help other survivors by subscribing to the podcast on whatever platform you listen to, and sharing it far and wide with everyone you know. Please consider posting it on your social media and make sure to follow us on ours. Dear Katie is completely produced by an amazing group of volunteers. So thank you to all of them for giving of your time and heart. And thank you, listeners, for being present today. Always remember, self-care is essential to healing and to thriving.
Thank you so much, Clara. And again, Emma, thank you for taking us through all your life's journeys. And I think you've given a lot of hope and courage to those who, you know, haven't figured out how to navigate. And you were gracious enough to talk about some of your low points and struggles. So thank you for sharing that as well. And to our listeners, please continue to tune in and join us again for another episode of Dear Katie. Take care, and we'll talk to you again soon.